This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Everybody to Wrestling Omakase. It is episode number 177, and this week I am very pleased to be joined by a returning guest. Hello, Gerard.
Hey, John, how's it going?
Pretty good. What you been up to?
Nothing, but I had a rather bizarre week because I had two WWE matches that could make my top 10 at the end of the year.
Okay, well, I'm sure one of them is Walter and Ilya, which I haven't watched. What the hell's the other one?
Oh, Bailey and Sasha.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that. I haven't seen either one of them yet. So there's something about like hyped WWE matches that make my brain go, don't watch it. Like, I just don't.
Well, I didn't go as high on Walter and Dragunov as some people did, but I think it's got to be in discussion for like at least like somewhere in the top 10, possibly. But we'll see when I compile my list at the end of the year.
Yeah. But yeah, there's nothing else going on, I guess, huh?
No, things here in Toronto sort of took a turn for more infections. So we had, like, restaurants are now just takeout only again. The gym's closed. And so we're just waiting on that. They sort of want to open them up next weekend. But the actual, like, the Ontario government does. But the health officials are like, this is too soon.
Yeah, so. New York is still hanging in there. I have no idea how. Because every other fucking state surrounding us has been awful. I mean, New Jersey is like really climbing, you know, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, but I don't know what the hell New York is doing, but like we're the only state that things are still not that bad here. But
we're getting more cases than we were like during the original lockdown in like March, April.
Yeah, we're not. I mean, the original lockdown, we were like obviously the worst place in the world. I mean, but still, like the last time I checked, the positivity rate was still like under 2% here. So I don't know. I don't know what we're doing right, but every other surrounding state looks much worse right now. But I'm sure people don't want to hear that stuff. So
at this point. It's sort of weird. Like there's a certain like level of like I've been very careful, but I just feel like the way that people talk about life in general now has a certain sense of like pandemic almost become the new normal, unfortunately.
You got cut off there. You said pandemic.
It's the way that people just sort of talk about like life, like, oh, how are you doing? It's sort of this weird, like, there's a certain acceptance of the new normal that this is how it caused.
Yeah.
Than it was the way that people were talking in like April, May.
Well, I mean, it's like there's no end in sight. So at this point, what are people supposed to do, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, you know, I mean, maybe hopefully be over by the end of 2021. Who the fuck knows at this point? Yeah. But yes, what was I going to say? I was going to say, you did step on my joke there, because I was about to say, nobody wants to hear about this topic. What they want to hear about is the United States election, which, of course, is on Tuesday. I don't know. I don't have any election hot takes. I think Trump's going to lose. I hope to God Trump loses, but I don't really have any hot takes.
I don't, like, early voting is something that, well, I say this as a Canadian, but the sort of trends of early voting in the U.S. is sort of like the Americans are not, except for like states like Washington State, they're not like early voters, male voters generally, like mail-in ballots.
Well, some states are, like Colorado.
Some states are, yeah. But on the whole, I don't know how that's going to sort of like turn into like what that the turnout means, because like I'm seeing these like Texas counties that are already doing more turnout than they had in 2016 just on early voting.
Yeah, it's crazy. Now,
what that means in the Texas context, I don't know.
I mean, I voted this past Wednesday. I did the early in-person voting because, you know, I'm lucky to live like 10 minutes. My normal polling place is like a minute away. Honestly, like it's like the school that I could walk to in a minute. But I was just figuring, like, you know, they might be, I don't know, I just kind of figured there might be a lot of crowds. So I just walked the 10 minutes to the early voting place in this church, which apparently was really, really long lines when the early voting first started. But by the time I did it this past Wednesday, like, I walked right in. Like, there was nobody there. So that was nice. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know, folks. I don't know what's going to happen. Hopefully we know who wins by the end of the week, and hopefully it's not Donald Trump. I don't really have any other big hot takes, but I'm ready for this to be fucking over. That is for sure. Like, I never want to hear about another election after this fucking thing is over. Because it's like, people are like, oh, we got to start 2024 watch. I'm just like, fuck off. How about that? Just fuck off forever.
But, well, I mean, even if Biden wins, given how trends are, you got to worry about 2022 to make sure the Democrats don't lose the House.
Yeah, they probably will. Whatever. Like, when your default position is like this entire country is like completely doomed and unsalvageable, I mean, I'm never optimistic. I just kind of hope that we get this fucking dipshit out of the White House. But anyway, that's also not why people are here. But please, if you're in America and you haven't voted yet, please go vote and please vote for Joe Biden. I know he's not great, but you know, whatever, if by chance I have somebody listening who needs to be reminded to go vote, because I doubt I have that many Trump supporters listening. If I do, look, I'm making a middle finger to the microphone. But no, I mean, like, fuck you if you're a Trump supporter. But if you're a Biden supporter, please get out there and vote. If you're a Trump supporter, please don't. Please just stay home. And fuck you. Anyway, back to what we're here to talk about today, which is WCW Halloween Havoc. So I should introduce, I guess, the new concept here. Basically, I've enjoyed the five matches episodes a lot. What I've noticed is we get a lot of, I don't know, like a lot of really, really, really great matches, right? Yeah, because people generally pick really great matches for this. I've tried to pick some shitty ones to mix it up. Like, I picked on the Patreon with Nate from Everything Elite, I picked the WCW Junkyard Battle Royal from Batch at the Beach, which was, if anything, even more horrendous than I remembered it being. And then with Mike Spears this past week, also from Everything Elite and Open the Voice Gate, also on the Patreon, I picked the main event, the very first Toriumon X show, which again was quite a bit worse than I remembered it being. I just saw that like on the list of matches that was on DGNet, and I was like, well, we have to watch this. I mean, but yeah, it was that Mike Spears episode, by the way, is a lot of fun. If you're not a patron, we're recording this on October 31st. So if it happens to get up today and you happen to listen to it, wait a day, because otherwise you'll get charged twice, and I'm not trying to rip you off. But yeah, November 1st, obviously the best time to join, you know, anytime early November, you get the whole month's worth of stuff. And you can hear that episode I did with Mike Spears last week, which got rave reviews from a few people who listened to it. So it was a lot of fun for that five matches episode. We went 2 hours and we rambled a whole lot about, like, you know, New Jersey, shitty New Jersey indies and, you know, all this other shit. I don't even remember half the shit we talked about, but it was a lot of fun. So definitely go check that one out. I might as well make this the Patreon plug in general, I guess. It's patreon.com/wrestlingomakase. You get all the content that's already up there. So if you want to go back and listen to all of our G1 coverage, Champion Carnival, Noah N1 Victory, we do tons of one-match episodes. Right now I'm going through matches submitted by omakase patrons. You submitted one too, Gerard. And, you know, like the patron picks have been awesome. I mean, pretty much every match that's been submitted so far, we've done 6 out of the 9, have been, you know, just really incredible matches. So my patrons have great taste, apparently. But yeah, I mean, it was just some great, that's been a lot of fun. We'll probably do another round of those. So if you want to suggest me a match to review on the Patreon, you can do that. But yeah, that's what we've been doing lately. We also did all the Okada Tanahashi matches in chronological order. We did all the Naito Ishii matches in chronological order. Those series are up there complete, ready for you to listen to. Those are a lot of fun. And then coming up in November, we're going to be going back into tournament coverage. So we'll be covering every single... I mean, we'll be covering some on the free feed, but every single show that we don't cover on the free feed, we'll be covering on the Patreon. So you get every single New Japan Best of Super Junior show, every single World Tag League show, and every single DDT DO show. So we're going to cover the DO, so that should be a lot of fun. I think they're announcing the participants at Ultimate Party on November 3rd to tie back into. There's like two big Puro shows on November 3rd. It's really funny. I know it's like some kind of Japanese holiday. I forget which one. But do you know which one off the top of your head, Gerard?
I'm just going to take a stab and this might be the wrong one. Is it Seniors Day?
Let's see. No, it's Culture Day. There you go. Culture Day. A day of culture. So yes, Culture Day is going on in Japan at the same time we have our shitty election. So that's why there's like a big DDT show, DDT Ultimate Party, a big Dragon Gate show, Gate of Destiny, right? Osaka?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's those are both going on that day. But anyway, so at Ultimate Party, they're going to announce the DO participants, and we'll be covering that on the Patreon. Should be a lot of fun. And again, it's only $5 to get access to all this stuff I'm talking about, plus even more stuff I didn't even mention. So patreon.com/wrestlingomakase to get all of that. Now, back to the concept here. I wanted to do retro stuff, you know, but like in a different way. So I came up with this retro roulette gimmick. Now, this is not a new concept. There's plenty of other podcasts that have done like random wrestling matches before. It's only a new concept for Omakase, but I figured a great first one to do would be Halloween Havoc, since today is Halloween, first of all. And I just kind of got the urge to watch some old WCW. Now, watching some old WCW really got rid of that urge very quickly. Like, by the time I was on the fourth or fifth match, I was like, this is a terrible idea. Why did I do this? Because, like, not that all these matches were bad. Some of them were pretty good. But, oh my god, these fucking finishes. I could not believe... Like, every single... We pick six matches at random, okay? So, first of all, I pick six shows at random. So, six Halloween Havocs. We got 93, 94, 95, 96, 98, 99. So, those are the six shows that were picked at random. And then I picked one match from each show at random, too. I picked six out of whatever matches. Every single one of them did not have a clean finish. Every single one had some kind of terrible finish. And it was like, did they just... Like, I remember Nitro being nothing but terrible finishes, but I guess I honestly forgot, like, how bad the finishes were on WCW pay-per-views. I don't know. Were you surprised by this, or did you just not have any... You're just like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
I was more surprised that some of the mid-card stuff had the... unclean finish.
Right, like Perry Saturn can't just...
Hogan match should be different, I think.
Like, Perry Saturn can't just beat Eddie Guerrero? Like, what the fuck? Like, that was the shit that really surprised me. It's like, yeah, main event, fine. But Perry Saturn can't just beat Eddie Guerrero or vice versa. It's like, it's incredible. I don't know. Like, it makes me want to go through these shows and be like, did any of these matches have clean finishes? It is like, it's incredible. But, we're gonna go through them one at a time here. We'll also talk about some of the stuff we missed along the way that the randomizer did not give us, which could have been better or worse. But yeah, that's a general idea. So do you have any like big picture thoughts where you get into each match?
I miss those Halloween Havoc sets.
The sets were awesome.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean I don't know, like they, at the same time, it made me, you know, I get the nostalgia was there. Cause it's like, at least when I put this on, you know, it was just a bunch of wrestling matches. I mean, like, I feel like, you know, American wrestling has gotten so fucking far away now from being wrestling, right? And I'm not trying to sound like old man yells at cloud, but, like, I don't know. It just feels like everything in American wrestling now is, like, a soliloquy, you know, like a fucking, like, some kind of play, you know, with Roman and Jey Uso. Or, you know, a literal song and dance with Jericho and MJF, and like, I don't know, it's like...
Well, we didn't watch the WCW mini-movies.
Oh, I actually did watch one.
Oh, did you?
But yeah, so many movies were there. That's true. That's a good
but
point.
I will say that even the shitty matches still felt like a lot more traditional pro wrestling than some of the stuff you see today.
Yeah. So actually, that's a great transition, the mini movie. So 1993, the non-title, spin the wheel, make the deal, Cactus Jack versus Big Van Vader. That's the first one we got. I did watch the opening of the Halloween. Did you watch the opening of this 93 Halloween Havoc?
I didn't know.
Okay.
Oh, but so I have seen it before.
It starts with... I had never seen this, so this is amazing. It starts with a bunch of, like, Southern kids arguing, okay? This is, like, one of the infamous mini-movies, but really one of the lesser-known ones, I feel like. So the kids... And keep in mind, this is how a wrestling pay-per-view began. The kids head up to a very spooky-looking house. One of the kids keeps saying, "Let's just go home and watch Halloween Havoc," which I thought was just kind of funny. No kid was ever saying that in 1993. A stoned and very young-looking Tony Schiavone answers the door. Not at all who I was expecting to be in this mini-movie. He invites them inside to eat cookies in the creepiest manner possible. Like, the Seven gimmick, remember in 99, they thought was like a pedophile thing? Like, this was like, oh my god. He invites them inside, you know, like, to eat cookies, like I said. And then... like, this thing is just... you have to see this if you've never seen it before. He makes this creepy smile at the camera as he closes the door. Like, the creepiest smile of all time. And he starts telling them about spin the wheel, make the deal. The kids don't give a shit about this fucking stipulation. And one of the kids, like, pokes him in the nose repeatedly and says, "I don't care about WCW. Show me something spooky." Tony says, "Fine. You kids want to be scared?" He pulls off his face to reveal some kind of werewolf monster, and then we just fade to the wheel. I guess he eats the kids, but there you go. I don't even know. Like, what? Why that was made, I have no idea. What that was supposed to accomplish, I have no idea. It's never talked about. Like, they just go, Tony's just there. He's like, "Hi, kids, I'm here." That's right. We opened up with me killing these children, but I'm here. And it's like, what? I don't know. Maybe I have seen this. I just totally forgot about it. But, like, that was something.
Schiavone plays a tremendous creep.
he really does, apparently. So this match we got the main event here, which was the non-title spin the wheel, make the deal match, which it ended up being a Texas death match. I watched them spin the wheel, too, which they did not even try to pretend they weren't gimmicking this wheel. I mean... this wheel slowed down, like, to a crawl before it got to Texas Death. So, as far as other stuff we could have gotten this show, I really don't remember this show very well, so I don't know what was good or bad, looking at the card. I would have kind of liked to see Dustin Rhodes and Steve Austin, I guess, for the U.S. title. That could have been cool. You know, Sting versus Sid Vicious only went, like, 10 minutes. That might have been interesting. Ric Flair against Rick Rude for the International World Heavyweight title, the very different title there.
But that one ended in a DQ, so yeah, I don't know how that would have been.
And it went almost 20 minutes, too. Yeah, Dave only gave it 3 1/4. Anything stand out to you on this card that we either were saved from or you know, should have watched? It seems like it was a pretty good show. I mean, it has a 7.121 cage match.
To me, it would be the Dustin and Austin match, because I've actually been watching some old Steve Austin stuff. Actually watched the match like 2 weeks ago, the match where he injured Chono's neck for the first time.
Oh yeah,
because it's on New Japan World, and it's an awesome match. I mean, it sort of falls apart at the end because Chono's like got his bell rung and he just sort of slapped on that STF out of nowhere for the win, but up until that pile driver, it was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I really love Austin in his WCW run, so that would have been interesting to see. But yeah, there's nothing on this card where I'm like, oh, thank God we didn't get that. I mean, the opener sounds pretty bad. Charlie Norris, Ice Train, and the Shockmaster defeating Harlem Heat and the Equalizer. That was probably pretty bad. So I guess we dodged a bullet there, but not a lot otherwise. Let's see here. So let's get into the actual match, I guess. I have to say, this is a pretty famous match, and, you know, it has some pretty high ratings in places. I mean, Dave gave it 4 3/4. I was pretty disappointed. I don't know how you felt about it, but, like, it did not hold up for me. You know, it was good, but, like, not, like, you know, one of the best matches ever or anything like that, because and we'll get into it, I guess, as we go. But like, there's, you know, it is, there's a lot of stuff that is very brutal, but I think, you know, a lot of stuff that's just like, well, you know, it doesn't really hold up in 2020 eyes, and like, the finish is just like horrifically bad, which we'll talk about. And that if anything, you know, like one of the worst finishes for a major main event I've seen in a while. And like, it took, I took like half a star off. That's how much I hated that finish. But I don't know. Do you have any big picture thoughts on the match before we get into the recap?
Yeah, it doesn't hold up, but it has the brutality. So I can sort of understand if you're looking through 1993 eyes and you've never seen like Japanese death match or something, that it would have been like, holy shit, what is this? But yeah, and then it just sort of falls apart at the finish.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, it was going, it had its moments of greatness, but it just had like that part where they sort of like go into the grave and underground.
Yeah.
Where they blade, and it's like, this is just a stupid waste of time. You guys are professionals. You could have bladed like by not doing that.
So they explained the very simple Texas Deathmatch stipulation in about the dumbest and most confusing way possible. Gary Meckel-Capetta was the ring announcer at this point, right?
I think.
So he says, here's a direct quote. Falls don't count. 30-second rest period between falls. Back to back. Huh? So the falls don't count, but there's a 30-second rest. Now, what he's trying to say is the falls don't end the match. But, like, it just doesn't really make any sense.
Well, that 30-second rest period is also crappy. And
yeah! I think that wasn't, like, how they were all done back in the day, right? I don't remember that.
No, I don't remember
that at all. And, like, the 30-second rest period, it's, like, it sucks a lot of the drama out of it because it's, like... So, basically, in a normal Texas death match, which I just covered one on the Omakase Patreon, that was awesome, Irie and Akito from DDT in 2015. A normal Texas death match is just, like... You pin the guy or submit the guy, and then immediately they start a 10 count. So it's like a last man standing match where you have to pin the guy first, which I think works better than a last man standing match because you don't get, like, you still get all the normal near falls of a wrestling match without having to get, you know, have the guy slowly count to 10 every single time he's knocked down. So that part of it's good. The problem here is the 30-second rest period they put in here, it totally saps the match of the drama because after every time someone gets pinned, they don't just start counting. They give them 30 seconds to recover, and then they start counting. And, like, the guy's already back up, practically.
They were on their knees when the 10 count started, like, I think in almost every fall.
Yeah, it just, it sapped a lot of the drama out of it. So that was just a brain fart that just didn't work at all. And I'm glad that did not become standard for the stipulation. So Jack, he jumps Vader on the ramp, and they start brawling immediately. Jack comes back, like, by biting Vader. And we get like a steel chair shot directly to the head of Vader that definitely would not fly today. And then Vader uses his very stiff offense in the ring, which busts Jack open under his eye hard way. And then Jack comes back by suplexing Vader from inside the ring onto the elevated ramp. And then Jack gives him a Saito suplex out there for good measure. This stuff is good. Like, this stuff is really fun. Then we get to the part you talked about where they go up to the graveyard. They fall into Vader's grave. Cactus gets up first and climbs out. This grave, quote-unquote, it's not like those WWE Buried Alive matches where they, like, you know, they have a plot of land and they dug a grave and everything. It's just a big hole in the stage, complete with the steps to get in and out. It looks weird. It does not look anything like a grave. So, you know, that's not a great thing right there, like, aesthetically. And like you said, Cactus climbs out first, heads back to the ring. Vader takes forever and comes up all bloody, like he bladed, which is, you know, like you said, it's just kind of silly. It's like, these guys can't blade without falling into a fake grave. But yeah, I don't know. Then Jack, Cactus Jack, like, runs over, immediately hits a big clothesline on the ramp, covers him. It looks like a two count. Jesse Ventura on commentary thought it was a two count, but I guess Vader actually kicked out right after three. So that's our first pin of the match, which is not a great start for the pins. And then Vader gets his 30-second rest period before the ref starts counting. He gets up immediately because, again, he had 30 seconds to recover. And then Jack immediately hits him with a fake cactus. That's kind of funny. But, yeah, they brawl and brawl here. Jesse gets an all-time great burn in here. Do you remember what it was?
No.
Here's the direct quote. I guess the only positive thing out of it is they were both pretty ugly to begin with, so they're not going to get no uglier. I laughed a lot at that. That was a great line.
I was going to say Jesse and Tony are actually pretty underrated. I think as
yeah, they were a fun type. They were a fun commentary team.
And then Tony was dressed as Jesse Ventura
yeah.
as a Halloween costume in this.
Yeah. That was pretty good. When does Jesse leave? It's like 94, right? Pretty
when Hogan comes in.
Yeah. But yeah, so Vader. There's like a really, there's a very silly spot here. So they set this table up in the ring. Vader, Jack eventually like sends Vader like into his stomach first, which looks very silly because Vader basically goes running toward it and then jumps in midair like, here I come, table. Like he's trying to give it a hug or something. And it doesn't even break. It just looks very goofy.
The table didn't look like it was going to break.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
You know, Jack gets a two count off that, then hits him with the table. Vader does hit Jack with a pretty brutal looking chair shot. He got one of these like thick chairs, not like a pro wrestling steel chair. And he looks like he hit him with the legs of the chair too. And this is also where we see Harley Race, you know, has a taser, which will unfortunately play into the finish. Vader like very slowly climbs to the top and hits the Vader salt. Looks pretty bad, as his moonsaults always did, but who cares, because he's gigantic and did a moonsault. That lets him pin Cactus for the first time, but Cactus beats the count pretty quickly after the rest period. But yeah, they end up back on the ramp. We get the famous Vader falling backwards with Cactus on his back spot. That does look fucking brutal. And this crowd has not been great, but even they reacted big to that one, because it looked like Vader just killed Jack. Unfortunately, Vader then picks up a chair. He plasters Jack upside the head with it. That's good. But then he hits a pretty bad-looking DDT on the chair. I mean, like, Jack, his head made, like, no contact with the chair at all. And that's, like, a big spot in the match because...
be fair to Mick Foley, he didn't need any more contact
true.
Head to the chair, yeah.
That's true. But they tease the stoppage. They bring out the trainer. And I wish that kind of had been the finish, given what they did after that. So Vader pushes the trainer away. Pins him. Jack recovers before the 30-second rest period is over. DDTs Vader on the chair. They both fall down. The referee starts the 10 count anyway. I don't know why he's counting 10 when Jack was already back up. It's like, basically, apparently you can recover during the 30-second rest period, do another move, and then if both of you, both guys are down, they'll just start the 10 count anyway. It's very stupid. I mean, like, why are we even counting Vader down? Vader's not the one who got pinned. Because he's counting both of them down. And it's like, it doesn't make any sense. And then, to add to the nonsense, Harley Race hits Jack in the leg with the stun gun. Jack falls back down. And that makes Vader the winner, because he's up and Jack isn't. So Jack immediately recovers anyway. And DDT's Harley Race. Okay. So a lot of this is fun in a car crash type of way. A lot of it is very slow and plotting. And the ending is horrible. So horrible. They just should have done the fucking stoppage finish they were teasing after the DDT. Because, like, it doesn't make any sense that Jack got back up in 30 seconds after they were just teasing that he was out. It doesn't make any sense that Jack DDT Vader and then the ref started counting both of them out when, you know, Vader wasn't the one who got pinned. And obviously the stun gun shit just fucking sucks. And then he no-sold afterwards anyway. He got right back up in DDT to Harley Race. I went 3.5. The finish is so bad, to me it takes off half a star. It's just not at all a satisfying payoff to what was a very physical match before that. It just doesn't work at all, the finish. So, there you go.
I just went 3 stars. I mean, you know, it was there and I liked some of the brutal hits, but that was it, you know. It's like, oh. And the finish sucked and everything. And one part that I laughed out loud at this, you know, the first time they show Harley Race with the taser?
Yeah.
And then Tony's like, oh, what's that he's got there? And then he's like clicking it on. And then he's like, oh, I see the camera sees me and he hides it. And I'm like, this is like the lamest, like, I'm hiding something from everyone thing. Like, Harley Race is interesting because they book him doing the stupidest shit as a manager, but yet he still has pretty good, like, heel manager charisma.
Yeah.
I feel. But they just have him do the stupidest shit, as we'll talk about later as well.
He was just a fucking terrible manager. I mean, like, not in the way he... Well, yeah, I mean, he was a terribly booked manager, I guess is the best way to put it. Like, he never came across to me as, like, someone who, you know, was really, like, helping his client you know, win or whatever. But, like, he had decent charisma and stuff, but he just always came off like, I don't know, he just always came off like a very ineffective manager. It was very weird. That brings us now to 1994, which is obviously the following year. A lot has changed in that year since now we're in the start of the Hogan era. The match we got here was Vader versus the Guardian Angel, which only went 8 minutes and 17 seconds. We'll get into who the Guardian Angel was if you don't know, because it's pretty funny. But we really fucking, you know, we dodged a lot of bullets on this show, looking at the card. Yeah. I mean, we could have gotten Johnny B. Badd versus the Honky Tonk Man, a 10-minute draw. We could have gotten, let's see, Dave, the epic Sullivan brother battle between Dave and Kevin. We could have gotten the Jim Duggan, Steve Austin DQ match that ends Austin's WWE career. The only good match I guess we didn't get that apparently was quite good was the WWE title match main event in the cage with Hogan and Flair. Dave gave that 4.25. I don't remember liking it that much, but it was pretty good.
Was it better than the... Like, I haven't seen it in so long, but I remember, like, thinking the Bash at the Beach 94 match was pretty good. And I'm just wondering if it's better than that, but I can't remember.
I think the Bash at the Beach one was better, but who knows? I mean, it was... The Hogan Flair matches always had a certain baseline to me, so I'm sure that probably was pretty good. But yeah, we dodged a bunch of bullets here. We got a pretty fun little match here, I think. I don't know what your overall thoughts were.
Yeah, I thought it was a fun little match. I mean, there's, like, little things you could critique about the finish.
Yeah.
You know, but it was fun while it lasted.
As we're talking about, all these finishes were fucking terrible. But yeah, so this is more Vader, obviously. He's our only wrestler who shows up twice here. You know, this is one of his matches in his long feud with Ray Traylor, a.k.a. the Big Boss Man, a.k.a. now the Guardian Angel. They wrestled each other 27 times in 1994, if you include house shows. Without house shows, it's about 6 times. So Vader defeated the Boss at Spring Stampede in April 94. Very shocking that WWF would have a problem with that name. Just like, I always thought that was like so.
And then, but the commentary didn't help because they're like, he's the Boss. Oh man, he's big. You know?
Oh, they would say like that stuff. Yeah. Yeah. It really is something. But yeah, they basically threatened to sue them. And then, WWF, so they changed this gimmick to the Guardian Angel, which was, okay. So the Guardian Angels are like this group of, I don't know, like neighborhood watches, right? I've never seen one in real life, so I have no idea.
They were a lot bigger in the 80s during like the New York crime wave and stuff like that. And that's where they sort of came into like prominence. But they sort of, I guess they still exist, I'm not sure. But I think their relevance has faded away now that like, crime has dropped and everything like that.
Yeah, so they're basically just like, you know, narcs, right? They're basically just like,
yeah, people, they basically are, yeah.
Yeah, standing around and looking for shit to narc on. They have these like wacky, I don't know, like maroon jackets, I guess. But yeah, so he, I mean, it kind of was a clever little rebranding, I guess. I mean, it makes sense, you know, if you're going to have a babyface cop and you can't do the cop gimmick, then I guess do a babyface Guardian Angel gimmick. But I think the Guardian Angels got mad, right? That's why they had to change it.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. So, because he turns heel basically after the end of this feud in early 95, he turns heel and he goes back to being Big Bubba Rogers. And I think that's the gimmick he uses until he leaves. So,
which was fine. He had like what he wore, the, like the suspenders and the shirt and everything. It was like a perfectly good gimmick that these like sort of attempting to, they were obsessed with like keeping it somehow close to Boss Man, which was just so indicative of WCW.
Yeah. And then you know, I think he's what, he's in like, I think he's in the Dungeon of Doom until he leaves basically, but I don't know. But yeah, so Vader beats Guardian Angel by DQ at Bash of the Beach in July. Guardian Angel beats him by DQ on an episode of Main Event in August. Vader beats Sting and Guardian Angel in a number one contendership triangle match at Fall Brawl, which he would not get the title shot until what, like fucking February, I think. So that was a real number one contender match there. And then Guardian Angel beats him by DQ again on an episode of Saturday Night a few nights later. And now this is their sixth and final meeting on TV here from Halloween Havoc. These matches all kind of blended together for me, so I don't often remember which is which, but I remember them having some pretty good chemistry, so I was excited to watch this. The recap video showed us how Guardian Angel got DQ'd. He got DQ'd for not hitting Vader with a nightstick. Did you see this?
Yes.
Like, Vader tried to bring it in. The Angel picked it up, held onto it for like a million years. It's like, sir, if you're not going to hit him with this, why don't you just put it down? He held onto it for so long before the referee just assumes he must have hit him with it and DQ'd him.
If you pick up a weapon, don't you have to drop it in the five count anyway, though?
Yeah, I guess so. The referee didn't start any count, though. He just looked at him with the fucking weapon and was like, DQ! So, I don't know. And then we see the DQ from Saturday night with Vader and Race leaving him laying, and there we go. A bunch of other Guardian Angels lead him to the ring here, which I thought was, I'm sure those are probably just indie wrestlers, but who knows. They claim it's other members of the Guardian Angels from all throughout the United States, so, you know, I doubt that, but who knows. Vader spots Muhammad Ali at ringside and gives him a "You're the Man," which Muhammad Ali looks like he could barely remember his name at that point, but that was pretty cool just for Vader to do that, you know. Because obviously Vader always said he was the man, so. Then we see the Guardian Angel goes... So basically, the story of this match, Guardian Angel goes right after Harley Race when he comes out. At first, it's kind of smart, because he seems like he's been getting involved in all of these matches. The problem is he just does not let this go, and it will eventually come back to bite him. Vader, which is actually kind of funny, he doesn't seem to give a fuck about this vicious assault on his beloved manager, because he starts off the match by just posing. And it's like, buddy, he just beat the shit out of your manager. Like, you don't care at all? But I guess not.
It's sort of weird to see Harley taking those bumps and that, because his neck and back were so fucked even at that point. Like, that's like why he had to retire from in-ring competition.
Yeah.
So I mean, sort of like, ugh.
This is like the end of his managerial career too, right? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, he's not around much longer after this.
Yeah, because I don't remember him being around in, like, he's not out there with Vader in 95 during that the Hogan-Vader feud, I think. So, I don't know. Yeah, but he's definitely gone whenever Vader's gone. Vader, you know, he comes back with, you know, Angel gives him these slaps to the face. Vader comes back with these palm strikes and his own clubbing blows to the Guardian Angel. We get a great call from Tony here. Tony's like, Vader's doing what he does best. He's a big grizzly bear. He mauls you. Just, you know, he really, like, puts over the top that Vader is, like, you know, this animal. Vader just, like, continues pounding away. He holds on to Angel's wrist. We get some wrist control here in October 94. And then he clotheslines him all the way to the floor. Angel, like, he takes this weird, almost slow-motion bump as he heads over, but the landing looks kind of cool. Like, he just snaps his head down there, so it works by the end of it, I guess.
Yeah, he's always a great bumper.
Yeah. On the floor, Angel, like, reverses Vader, sends him into the railing, clotheslines him and pounds away. He nails Harley Race when Harley tries to attack him from behind, and then he sends Harley in the ring and just slams him and keeps pounding on him. Vader comes in after him, and Guardian Angel just keeps pounding on him. And then he slams Vader onto Harley pretty hard, which, like you said, for a guy who was, like, retired at this point, that looked like it sucked. The crowd really loved it, though, so. Harley Race rolls to the floor. Angel keeps stomping on... He teases stomping on Vader's balls, but then he settles for a leg drop. Just keeps pounding. He hits a Stinger Splash in the corner, which, another great call from the announcer. The Brain describes it as being, like, two Amtraks colliding. I just thought that was kind of funny. It's like, why was Amtrak in the news in 1994? Just kind of funny. Angel tries to suplex Vader. Vader reverses, but Angel eventually does get the big suplex. Vader, though, comes back with these vicious-looking punches and a big clothesline to the face, which is his first bit of offense in forever. He tries the second rope shoulder block off of there, but Angel, like, catches him in midair and slams him. That looked awesome. That's probably the best spot of the match, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely.
Angel hits a sloppy-looking diving headbutt, but Vader...
Oh, I hated that diving headbutt. I had that in my notes. One of the worst diving headbutts I've ever seen, actually.
It was
because
really
he lands on his knees, basically. And then decides to, like, drop his head down on Vader.
Yeah, it was really bad. Vader kicks out, too, thankfully. We get, like, a... But he follows that up with a pretty nice-looking enziguri, which you would not expect a nice looking Enziguri from a Ray trailer, but it worked here. And he does like a cross chop to the throat and a palm strike. He's like trying all sorts of shit here. Angel just like, there was an ugly spot where like, okay, so it seems like both guys were on different pages. Invader ends up hitting a clothesline. Angel just kind of awkwardly goes down like he wasn't expecting that, you know? Like, it really looks quite bad and, like, hurts the momentum the match had been building up at that point. Vader then slams Angel down, goes to second rope and hits the Vader bomb, covers him. Angel kicks out too. I was a little surprised that wasn't the finish. It would have been a perfectly fine finish. Vader goes up again, tries a second Vader bomb. This time Angel gets his knees up. He hits his own, like, standing splash and gets a two count. He has a quick and like a little bit sloppy looking spine buster. Tony inexplicably calls that a sidewalk slam, which I'm like, sir, I feel like he called a hundred different.
I heard that call and I was like, what is a sidewalk slam? Because I've heard a lot of things called the sidewalk slam. And I always thought the spine buster was like the way that Arn Anderson does it with the, he twists over, right?
Yeah. I mean, I thought the sidewalk slam was like the, that side slam where like you're almost like going to do a backbreaker, but instead you just slam the guy down. But I don't know. Who fucking...
Okay, yeah, right. I just thought that was a side slam because, like, you know, the Rock's spine buster, I did think that was a sidewalk slam.
I see.
So that was my confusion, but I could be wrong. But that's just what I always assumed that was the difference between the two moves.
Well, whatever. It doesn't matter. But the point is, though, Angel then hits the Boss Man Slam, which is called the Spike Slam here. But instead of just... Okay, and here's where things get very stupid. He's on top of Vader, right? He lands on top of Vader. Instead of trying to just staying on top of him to cover him, he inexplicably starts chasing Harley Race after Harley was, like, sort of getting up on the apron. But who cares? I mean, he can't do anything from there. If he jumps in the ring and attacks you, then you win by DQ. Just pin the guy. He chases Harley Race before Harley's even done anything. He suplexes him back in the ring, but just as he lands, Vader splashes him, and that's the fucking pin. Like, wow. Another, we're 0 for 2 here on good finishes. Like, the timing at the end was almost impressive. You know, like, when Vader's slamming him the moment he hit the ring from the suplex. But to me, it doesn't make it any less of a stupid finish. Just pin the guy. Why are you chasing Harley Race? But yeah, I don't know. It was a pretty enjoyable little power battle that I was quite into at times. But, like, I can't go higher than, like, 3.25 after that fucking finish. So I don't regret watching it. But, you know, they book a fucking clean finish, WCW.
I also went 3.25 on this for more or less the exact same reasons and a little bit of sloppiness. But it was really fun. But, John, do you know what title, non-WCW title, Vader was holding at this time in this match?
Was it like UWF or something?
Yeah, he was a UWFI champion. So it was just sort of funny to sort of like see the contrast there.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. Just say, this match, like, I think if you're only going to watch one match where we talk about, you might as well watch this one because it was not that long and, you know, it was pretty fun. But, like, I don't know. Like, just why can't Vader just beat Ray Traylor? Would the world end if Vader just hit a Vader bomb on fucking Ray Traylor and pinned him?
Well, it goes for the same for the last match. Like, Cactus Jack wasn't that protected either.
Yeah.
Right? It just does, you know.
I don't know. The finishes are terrible. Moving on to 1995. So we missed a lot of shit here on this show. The match we got was Lex Luger versus Ming, which was pretty bad. But there was also, you know, like, looking at this card, there was Randy Savage and Zodiac, which only went a minute and 30 seconds. Zodiac is Brutus Beefcake. We could have seen Kurosawa. Do you know who Kurosawa is? I know you know, but I don't know if the listeners know who that is. That is Manabu Nakanishi. And he took on Road Warrior Hawk. That only went 3 minutes. That would have been interesting. Sabu and Mr. JL, Jerry Lynn, which also went 3 minutes, was on this show. This is stuff I would have liked to see, honestly. So I guess we missed out on some good stuff. We might have seen the worst match on the show, looking at this card, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. We could have gotten Ric Flair and Sting against Arn and Brian Pillman, the famous Flair turn. We could have gotten Savage and Luger, which is the match Luger confusingly earned by beating Ming. And but actually, no, the main event was pretty terrible too, if I remember correctly. The Giant and Hulk Hogan.
What was the monster truck battle in the randomizer?
No, I didn't put it in the randomizer. I should have. But yeah, the Giant Hogan, that went 17 minutes. It was a lot longer, like 4 minutes, well, 4 minutes longer than the match we had to watch. So that was probably worse. So that match was pretty terrible. But yeah, that was the main event. But yeah, this was like a very weird period for WCW. Like the storylines were so weird during this period. Like Hogan was teasing going to the dark side, but it was actually a trick. And like Luger had come back to the company. Like, okay, if he wins this match against Ming, who remember is a heel, a member of Dungeon of Doom, Luger gets to face Randy Savage later. Why does Luger have to beat a member of the Dungeon of Doom to get a match at Randy Savage? I they never explained that. I have no idea.
I was going to say, I didn't know, and I wasn't going to bother to try to find out. But apparently, yeah, there was no reason.
Like, they never explained that, why Luger has to do that. Why did he want to fight Savage? I have no idea. I have no idea what their issue was or anything. Like, this was a little before my time. I didn't really start watching WCW as a kid until 1997. I've never gone back and watched, like, these 95, like, early Nitros. So I can't really tell you what the fuck is going on here exactly.
Well, yeah, Luger had only been back a month.
Yeah.
In the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card. But with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club Slab Pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show, and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it and look, it's gonna be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably gonna get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, ah, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing. You know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You can display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading. So you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, sending these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling required. Keyless entry, no more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio. And then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They are on standby for you 24/7 so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy Video Lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived. And really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys, reach in my pocket, or wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy Video Lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition, 1 second. Door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is E-U-F-Y Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, E-U-F-Y Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
Yeah. So Luca comes back. They're teasing some kind of conspiracy with the Dungeon of Doom. I think that eventually would be the case, because obviously he's on their team by the time you get to, March for that horrendous, uncensored steel cage match, the 10-on-2. I mean, he's on their team during that match. I don't know how we get there. I don't know what happens after that, because he's, again, a babyface again by the time the NWO invasion starts. So, I don't know. I have no idea. The crowd still reacts to him like he's a face here, so I guess he hadn't quite turned yet, but they definitely did tease there's some kind of conspiracy. Like, Luger, he attacks Ming right at the bell. We hear from the announcers that there's some kind of conspiracy because the dungeon never attacks Luger when they run out to attack other people. This is just like the Putty Patrol and Tommy and the original Power Rangers. Remember, they would never attack Tommy, and the other Rangers were finally like, huh, that's weird. And it turned out because he was the Green Ranger. But yes, I know, like I said, like by the time we get to Uncensored, Luger's like fully heel and team with the dungeon. But I don't know in the alliance to end Hulkamania. But I don't know how we get there. I really have no idea. So it's a very weird thing. And this match, boys, this match suck.
Oh my God, I can't believe. Are you even going to try to recap this whole thing?
I'm guessing you do not want me to, but I wrote down some stuff. Okay, so Luger, he grabs a side headlock. He stomps on Ming, catapults from the turnbuckle. Now, I always thought Ming's thing in WCW was like, he was this unbeatable monster, right? But he's getting his fucking ass kicked here. Like, Ming doesn't do anything in the early portion of this match, except he eventually rolls Luger up in a small package out of nowhere. A pretty good small package, actually. But, like, wasn't Ming, like, the big monster in WCW? Okay, like, what the hell?
I feel like Ming was booked more as a monster in the last couple years of the company than he was. I can't remember when he comes in.
Well, I don't know, but I remember a match with Sting from earlier this year at, like, Batch of the Beach, where, like, he no-sells, like, everything Sting does in that match. And, like, works it as, like, the total monster. So, I don't know. Very weird.
It's just WCW.
Yeah, I guess so. Because I remember that match pretty clearly. Like, he definitely no-sells, like, all of Sting's offense. So that's what I was expecting him to do here. But here he's, like, he's just fucking getting his ass kicked by Luger. But yeah, I don't know. Like Brain at one point says, it takes a lot to hurt Ming. But, like, he spent this entire match selling for Lex Luger. Like, Luger, if anything, is treating him like a fucking jobber. So, I don't know. We get, like... there's a great Brain line, too. He's, like, thinking about how... He's talking about how the Taskmaster, of course, Kevin Sullivan, is always thinking bad thoughts. And he says, quote, every day is Halloween havoc for the Taskmaster. I love that line. But, yeah, Ming eventually hits some punches that look like they missed by about 50 feet. Hits a kick to the gut and a shoulder block, which is, like, his first offensive flurry of the entire match. Luger does sell it pretty well. Luger was, like, always an underrated... selling guy for me. Like, he was pretty good at selling when he would do it. But then Ming, like, stretches Luger's arm in the ropes. He starts choking him in the corner. Very exciting. He finally hits a pretty nice pile driver that gets a two count. Pile driver did look pretty good. But then he chokes Luger some more and slaps on a chin lock, because the pretty cool pile driver was all the excitement we could handle, I guess. But yeah, Ming, you know, hits a backdrop suplex for a two count. Luger rolls to the floor. We get some super exciting nothing for a while before he just rolls back in. Do they really need to kill time in this show that badly? Like, I don't... Like, they just did nothing. Like, nothing at that point. Very exciting stomping from Ming as Luger rolls back in. And then Ming misses a dropkick, lands pretty hard. He charges Luger, gets back by a drop to the floor. Ming gets back up on the apron and goes for a superplex, but... Luger reverses and then suplexes, or not a superplex, just a regular suplex. And Luger reverses and suplexes Ming into the ring instead. And then Ming suddenly starts playing monster again. He, like, no-sells Luger's first two clotheslines, goes down for the third clothesline. Luger then Irish whips him, hits a big back body drop, two more clotheslines, a running power slam. But then Ming, while he's down, pulls out the golden spike. I don't even know what that is. Like, some kind of, like, little foreign object. Hits Luger with it. But when Ming covers Luger, Kevin Sullivan comes in and kicks Luger, laying under Ming. So apparently, since he kicked Luger, Luger wins by DQ, even though Sullivan was breaking up a pin that would have had Ming win. What the fuck?
It's a conspiracy.
Yes. So we're 0-3 in good finishes. Ming gets mad at Taskmaster. Taskmaster points out, now Luger fight. I can't do a Boston accent. He's like, now Luger fights Savage. Okay. Why Luger had to beat Ming to fight Savage anyway? I can't tell you. And just very stupid storyline. Match sucked. There were, like, a few moments and moves that were decent, but, like, the supposed monster did not start acting like a monster at all, or no selling anything until the very end of the match. Boring as hell all the way. Finish was terrible besides. I gave it 1 star. Probably a little generous, if anything. But there you go.
I went 1.5 star. I thought the first minute or two was actually decent. And I liked, like, Luger's sort of power up at the end with the power slam. But, God, everything in between was just absolutely dreadful. Like, say what you will about modern wrestling, but there's very rarely stuff that's this bad that makes TV these days.
Yeah, I mean, this is like... This really, a match as bad has not been on a major pay-per-view in a long time, I think. So, but you know. The next show we got here, we go to 1996. Now we're in the start of the NWO era. The match we ended up with was the Giant defeating Jeff Jarrett by DQ in 9:55. You know, the bullet we dodged here was probably that Hogan Savage main event, which I remember being quite terrible. But the rest of the card, there's some pretty good stuff. I mean, I definitely wouldn't have minded seeing Malenko and Rey Mysterio.
Oh, I love that match.
Yeah, for the Cruiserweight title. But, you know, some other good stuff here. DDP and Eddie always had pretty good matches, I think. So, but anyway, so this is during the epic Ric Flair wants Jarrett and the Four Horsemen, but the other Horsemen don't storyline. And Jarrett is, like, fresh into WCW. At this point, to start would be a very uneventful run. You know, his first match was a win over Hugh Morris in 4 minutes on the October 7th, 96 Nitro. So only a few weeks before this. Jarrett, he took until Starrcade to be officially made a Horseman member, if Wikipedia is to be believed. His run in the group does not last very long. He's kicked out, like, I think around May or June, by to start the big feud with the infamous Steve Mongo McMichael. And that feud goes pretty much until he leaves the company after just 1 year. When he shows up at WWF, he does like this big shoot interview on Raw.
And he
buries WCW for putting him in there with Mongo, which I thought was kind of funny. Which I'm sure that's how he actually felt. I mean,
he also like was critical of Vince, so he could sort of like get that edgy thing, right? Like, are you shooting on both companies type thing.
Indeed.
I also want to preface this by saying Jeff Jarrett is one of my least favorite wrestlers ever, and very few wrestlers have go away heat. I think really only two: Jeff Jarrett and Randy Orton for me. But I was pleasantly surprised with this.
Yeah, this was pretty good. Actually, I mean, what did I give it? Let me say. Because I don't remember what I rated this. I think I liked it less than you, but we'll talk about it, I guess. I accidentally wrote this down as Ric Flair versus the Giant on Twitter, when it's actually Jeff Jarrett with Ric Flair, so I apologize if you saw the tweets and thought you were getting Flair versus Giant, which probably would have been better. I want to give a shout out to the pre-match interview, because, like, this was such a cool setup and shows like the effort they put into this NWO thing early on that they would not put into it at all later on. Like, instead of just having normal interviews with, you know, the normal WCW people, they had Ted DiBiase up in the fucking crowd. Basically, they put a giant NWO banner, you know, over one of these entryways from the concourse into the crowd. And, like, they had this NWO corner of the building, basically. And it really did feel like their own separate thing that wanted nothing to do with WCW and vice versa. Like, this was the kind of little touch that made this angle work so well early on that they completely abandoned by the time you get to, like, probably even 97, definitely 98. I mean, look, this looks so cool. This, like, little NWO set.
I didn't watch the pre-match, but they... I watched like the post match, because the next match was Six versus Jericho, and I was like, I'm going to watch that. But yeah, DiBiase comes out again with Vincent and Six, and then Six enters through the crowd.
Yeah, that's how Giant enters during this match too.
Yeah.
So yeah, it really, it looks awesome. I mean, yeah, you know, like the, and Tony also lets me know as Giant comes down that he's not actually the US champion, even though he has the belt. And now I want to look up what the fuck happened with the US title, because I know that what's his name had to vacate it, Ric Flair. So that's why Giant basically injured Ric Flair, I guess, in storyline, and that's why they had to vacate the title. But I don't know. It's I don't know exactly what happened to it exactly. Let's see. Oh, okay, I don't know how they end up with a new champion or anything, but and Wikipedia does not want to load for me, but. Yeah, so they basically had a, you know, a storyline where the NWO kept stealing belts at this point. Because remember, Six stole the Cruiserweight title, too. So, let's see, the U.S. title.
Yeah, I was confused because I forgot that the Giant was already in the NWO at this point.
Yeah. Okay, so they didn't officially vacate the title until November. That's weird. November 25th. And then Eddie Guerrero is the next champion. He beats DDP in a tournament final for the vacant title in December 96. So yeah, that's that weird period where like Eddie and Dean Malenko trade the belt, and like they let the Cruiserweights have it for a little while, and then Jarrett wins it from Dean, and then it goes to Mongo and Kurt Hennig, and then back to DDP, and then they do the Raven stuff and all that. But that's a interesting little period for the title, I guess. But yeah, so Giant has the belt here. He's not the champion. Giant hands the belt to Nick Patrick, and Tony is outraged that Nick Patrick holds the belt up, since this is not a title match and Giant is not the champion. The camera completely misses this at first, by the way. Like, it completely misses it. We do finally see it as Jarrett comes out. The camera goes back to the ring and shows the Nick Patrick holding up the title. But there you go. Flair gets his own entrance for some reason. I don't know why. I guess just to give the crowd the Flair entrance, but because he has a
Jarrett's
major...
not over, and they need to, you know.
Yeah, Jarrett. The crowd does not give a shit about Jarrett. Apparently, which I totally forgot about. The NWO actually invited Jarrett, and he turned them down. So he was the first guy to turn down the NWO, not DDP. Which, yeah, I totally, because the DDP one I think is far more famous, when he like they keep offering him this shirt and he keeps like tearing it off and diamond cutting people and stuff. But yeah, apparently they offered Jarrett the NWO shirt and he kept turning them down.
It's funny because it's probably has to do with some backstage politics, because Jarrett's like a recently arrived WWF guy, but there's no way in hell Hall and Nash would want him in the NWO, like, yeah, as a shoot type thing.
Yeah. So Jarrett hits this like one jumping punch to Giant and immediately struts, which is actually pretty funny. He ducks a pair of clotheslines and starts strutting again, but then as Giant goes to grab him from another punch, you know, goes to grab him, he hits another punch and gets out of his way again. It's kind of clever that, I guess, that his idea is to stick and move, but how he's going to like strut him to death, I'm not really sure. Flair on the outside loves it, though. So, I guess, why don't you talk about what you liked about this match? Because I didn't like it nearly as much as you seem to have.
Well, I liked the whole, like, the way that they wrestled. Mm. It's so fun to see the Giant in 1995. He was awesome, I thought. I mean, limited, but he, in some ways, he played the character much better than he ever played the Big Show.
Yeah.
Who, like, I mean, like, the Big Show would take a lot of offense. Big Show would sell a lot. Here, he, you know, I mean, he sold, but it was a lot more credible, and he was, you know, selling from sort of the Jarrett's hit and run offense, you know. And then, I mean, if this had just had normal finish, I thought this would have been really great, because this is going through the Giant grabs him in the figure four with the choke, which I think he did. He not do that same spot to Ric Flair when he,
yeah, beat
Ric Flair to win the WCW title,
I think. Yeah, I think so.
And which was a nice little callback. And it was just basically the whole way the style was, it was wrestled. I thought it was like a very credible, you know, well, Jarrett's not small, but like versus an absolutely humongous man, a Giant played his role very well. I mean, obviously the finish sucked, so I had to deduct marks from that. But I mean, I just thought it was a really good way of how someone that is 7 feet tall should be wrestling a match.
Yeah. I mean, I liked it up to a certain point, but then it gets so ungodly boring to me that I took it down a lot, because, like, okay, so they do the stick and move stuff. That stuff is good. But then, like, you know, Giant hits, like, this elbow drop and, like, you know, does this long backbreaker rest hold over the knee. And then Flair grabs a mic, starts trying to cheer Jarrett on to get up and kick his NWO ass. And then Giant, you know, keeps clubbing Jarrett's back. You know, Jarrett keeps trying to fight back. Giant keeps clubbing him. You know, Jarrett goes for this crossbody off the corner turnbuckle. Giant easily catches him and then hits possibly the worst backbreaker I've ever seen. Like, he drops him like so lightly down under his knee that even Tony has to go, backbreaker. He hit him that hard with it, though. Like, even Tony Schiavone can't cover for that. He does hold on and hits a like, slightly better one, but it's only, like, you know, moderately better. And then Giant just, like, continues slowly walking around, clubbing Jarrett. It was really dragging for me at this point. He, like, whips Jarrett in the corner. Jarrett goes down. We get a very exciting bear hug. Jarrett gets out of it. You know, goes through Giant's legs very slowly after an Irish whip. Hits a pair of high drop kicks that stagger Giant. And then tries to slam like an idiot, and Giant falls on top of him for a two count. And then we get the incredibly terrible finish, like you said. So Giant, you know, tries a... maybe incredibly terrible, it's too strong, but just another shitty finish. Giant tries a singer splash with Jarrett up against the post on the floor. Jarrett moves. Giant collides with the post. Jarrett gets the figure four on the outside, apparently trying to win by count out, but Giant just sits up and easily grabs Jarrett by the throat to block it. He looks like he's going to go for the choke slam. Flair low blows him from behind, right in front of Nick Patrick. That's a DQ. Sometimes I feel like stuff on the outside is never a DQ, so that is also very inconsistent, right? Like, I feel like I've seen wrestlers interfere in matches a million times on the floor and not be a DQ. But it was a DQ here, apparently, so we're now 0 for 4 for clean finishes.
It's not New Japan in the outside.
And this is where, like, I was starting to wonder, like, did any WCW match ever have a clean finish? Because, like, we're on four different shows, four different matches, and they all have fuck finishes. It's like, okay. Then the other horsemen come out, and Tony and Dusty act like the Giant is a huge coward for not wanting to go 1-on-5. I'm just like, these fucking biased... I remember as a kid being like, wow, these WCW matches are very biased. Because, like, they would be really unfair to the NWO. Like, the NWO were heels. But, like, in situations like this, like, Tony and Bobby are like, oh, get in there, Giant. what are you doing, giant? And it's like, there's five of them. Why is he powerful enough to go one on five?
Giant's probably taken on five guys in WCW up before this point. They were maybe jobbers, but he's done it probably.
It's true, but like, didn't it come off to you as weird?
Yeah.
I mean, it was very weird. But yeah, I don't know. The best thing I can say about this is it wasn't as bad as I was expecting. I was kind of enjoying it early on when Jarrett was trying to stick and move. But it got so boring by the end, and the finish was again so bad. I only went 2 stars, so.
I went 3.5.
Okay, well, you really liked it then.
Yeah. One of my most hated wrestlers, too.
Like, yeah. No. I mean, I can see it, but like, it just, and I was enjoying it, but it got so fucking boring to me, so. The second to last match we're going to talk about here. Okay. 1998.
God.
Now, look, we could have gotten a much worse match, I have to say.
Oh, yeah, but this is just... But watching these two do this is what just makes it so infuriating and makes me angry.
So some of the other matches we could have gotten... we could have gotten Hogan and the Warrior, which is one of the worst matches of all time. We could have gotten the Steiner battle that went under 5 minutes. We could have gotten the Hall and Nash match. Remember that sucking. We could have gotten the... I don't even know. The Bagwell and Steiner against Steiner and Giant match. Okay. We could have gotten Kidman Disco Inferno. Disco Inferno. That was pretty good, if I remember correctly. We could have gotten the main event, which I remember being awesome.
Goldberg's best match, in my opinion.
Yeah. So, like, Dave really underrated that 3.25, I have to say. But yeah, the match we got was Bret Hart defeating Sting.
1998, Bret Hart.
Yes. In 1504 to retain the United States title. Oh boy. This match. I remember, like, I don't remember hating this match as much as I hated it here. Like, this match fucking sucked. Like, was fucking terrible. But before we talk about the things that sucked, let's talk about the positives. Bret Hart's WWE theme song was great. Like, when that theme song finally came out, that theme song was like, it always worked really well for him as a heel, especially. So I wanted to point that out. It was a great theme song. As a kid, I remember really finding Bret during this period, like, strangely intriguing, because it's like, he was clearly aligned with NWO Hollywood, but he would never wear the shirt for some reason. And this was, like, I guess, very fascinating to me when I was 12 years old. It's like, why would he put the shirt on? Because it was most absurd when, like, remember during the period where he was, would start this feud, which went on forever, he was trying to recruit Sting to NWO Hollywood, right? And he's like, is holding up the shirt. He's like, come to NWO Hollywood. I'm like, but you never put the shirt on, buddy. So why are you trying to
get... I feel like that's like Bret being like legit pissed off that he's in the position and being booked the way he is. And he's like, I'm not putting the fucking shirt on.
So you think it was a shoot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just angry. Like, I mean, look at him. He comes out. He doesn't have any, you know, he just seems so devoid of any charisma at this point. And to me, when he walks out, he's got the just a guy feels like, man, you're not like the one of the best wrestlers, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Just like, I can't handle watching 1998 Bret Hart. It's infuriating.
Now, of course, then when he was involved in the NWO 2000 reunion at the end of 99, he immediately puts the shirt on.
Because he was being pushed and he was the champion.
I remember being outraged about that, but you're right. That probably was it. But yeah, he takes forever to come out here too, for some reason. Like, his music is just playing for a long time before he even starts like walking out. Sting, of course, is in the red and black of the Wolfpack here.
He's got a goatee. Like, he's got the goatee,
which looks weird as hell.
Yeah.
This is the last appearance of the red and black though, because he does an injury angle at the end of this match. He doesn't return to TV until shortly before Spring Stampede in April, and that's well after the rest of the Wolfpack had turned heel and, you know, re-merged with Hollywood to form the last version of the original group. And they were, like, on pretty much petering out at the point when Sting even returned. I mean,
that Sting returned very well. Yeah.
Yeah, what was it like?
Yeah. It was hilarious because he returns in, like a couple weeks later, he wins the title on Nitro from DDP and then drops it back on the final hour of Nitro on the same episode back to DDP.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
But do you remember what he said? I don't remember what he said about the NWO or anything. I don't think he said
anything. No, I don't remember any of that. Yeah. And he wasn't even really feuding with them, was he?
No,
I don't think he was.
Because the NWA was pretty much done by that point, so it wasn't quite like there were still guys, but like yeah, you could tell it was like petering out. But yeah, like the you know, so when he comes back, he has his normal black and white face paint. It's the point. So Brett takes forever to get in the ring. Sting is.
I have in my notes Brett pulling a Jay White.
He takes a long time. Sting is brandishing a baseball bat, so that makes sense. Brett does finally get in when Sting gets in, but he immediately bails again when Sting gets into the ring. He keeps like begging off and staying behind the ref, and Sting comes after him. It feels so fucking fake because like even when Brett was a heel in WWF, he was never doing this begging off shit.
He was the best heel in the world at the time, I think.
And I don't remember him doing this fucking Ric Flair shit, but I don't know. Finally, Brett gets in the ring as the bell rings, and then Brett bails immediately again. He threatens to punch a middle-aged woman in a Goldberg shirt in the front row.
So oh, yeah,
was,
God.
That was funny. He had a big smile on his face. Not like he was really threatening to do it. Brett turns his back on Sting completely.
That was probably the most fun he had in the company in, like, all year.
Arguing with this middle-aged woman, yeah.
Yeah.
Inexplicably, he turns his back on Sting. Why? I have no idea. He just turns around suddenly and is like, I don't need to worry about Sting. And Sting comes after him and like grabs him and tosses him back in the ring at that point. He pounds away in the corner, gives him a weak clothesline. Brett is really like begging off like he's Ric Flair, which is, you know, not, an odd look for him even as a heel. You know, Sting punches him and sends him in the turnbuckle. You know, Sting whips Brett in the corner, stomps on him, keeps punching away with not much happening. Brett like fires back with much better punches, I have to say. Brett's punches were always awesome. Even during this period, apparently. Headbutts him and gives him the big face scrape over the top rope and a DDT. Gets a 2 count. Brett controls a lot of his usual offense. We got a Bret Hart sucks chant. He hits a leg drop for a 2 count. That one Bret Hart sucks chant is probably the most heat the match has the entire time. Because the crowd goes right back to being 100% dead right after. Not that I can blame them. But yeah, Brett like hits some uninteresting offense and then slaps out a chin lock to really bring up the excitement level here. The crowd does finally start chanting for Sting to fight back a bit as he gets out of it. But then Brett hits him with a knee to the chest to stop that comeback right away. Chokes him up against the ropes. Sting finally comes back and gets the Scorpion Deathlock, which does wake up the crowd a lot. But Brett makes the ropes pretty much immediately to put a stop to that. And then we get a fake knee injury spot. Because why not? Let's just do every fucking cheap Memphis heel bullshit here. Now, to Sting's credit, he does not fall for it at all. He gets a lot of shit for being a famously stupid babyface. Most of what he deserves, but he is not fall. Like, he's like, that man's not hurt. The referee falls for it, though, and like, keeps backing Sting up long enough for Brett to put on some brass knuckles or something, because, again, we're doing every cheap hate bullshit here. Sting, though, knocks Brett down, takes the brass knucks from Brett, goes to punch Brett with it. The ref grabs his arm to stop it, which I just found kind of funny. Like, this referee grabbing his arm, like, no, Sting! It's like, why don't you just let him do it and DQ him? Okay. Brett low blows him from behind with the ref out of position. I don't know. Does that spot count as clever? The live crowd doesn't seem to care. Okay.
Nothing in this match is clever.
We then get a much dumber spot. Okay. These next two spots are two of the dumbest spots maybe in wrestling history. Sting accidentally back elbows the referee, thinking it's Brett. He throws his elbow that's about 50 feet from the ref, Billy Silverman, I think, from his head, and Billy Silverman takes a bump. Now, how the fuck did you think, even feeling him, you know, like the air from his body, or him, like, putting his hands on you from behind, did you think Bret Hart shrunk half a foot? Like, Billy Silverman's a pretty tiny man. Like, what the fuck are you, like, why did you, like, elbow this man? Yeah, Brett immediately dropping the leg on him when he's down for good measure. That was pretty hilarious, I have to say. Like, he just doesn't even pause. He's like, boom, leg drop.
Things just really fell apart at this point, though.
Yeah.
Just, oh my God.
You know, so Sting keeps beating up Brett. I don't know what happens after this. Sting, like, it looks to me like Sting drops down to check on the ref in the middle of fighting Brett, but really, the announcers say Brett gave him a boot to the face, like, so devastating he had to lean over forever. It was very stupid. It goes nowhere anyway because Sting immediately, like, comes back and superplexes Brett off the top onto the dead ref's legs, which was like kind of funny. And then all three men just lay there for some real thrilling action. Sting goes for a stinger. Okay, here's the next dumbest spot of all time. So Bret Hart is in the corner. His back is facing Sting. His, you know, face facing the turnbuckle. Sting goes for a stinger splash, but he just slides over Bret and collides with the ring post, knocking himself out. So the big spot in the match that ends up being the doom of Sting is him going for his move and being a klutzy moron and hitting the post and knocking himself unconscious. What? What the fuck? I totally forgot about this. What the fuck was this? Why did they do that? Give me some answers, Gerard. Why did they do this?
I don't know, because I stopped trying to even think about this match at this point and trying to even like rationalize any of it.
I mean, just one of the dumbest spots we've ever seen. Like, why would you book a babyface to knock himself unconscious by his own fucking fall? It just doesn't make any sense.
This is what they thought was protecting Sting. Like, that's the only possible. I have in my notes the finish. Literally, if they had just ripped off the finish to Austin versus Hart from WrestleMania 13, this match would have been a lot better.
Yeah,
because I'm just talking about like, yeah, it still would have sucked, but it just wouldn't have been offensively bad.
So Bret then heads to the outside, grabs his baseball bat, beats him senseless with it, but he's very already unconscious. So who cares? Bret then hits him with the bat off the top to the throat, rolls the bat to the floor, revives the ref, drags him to his feet, locks Sting in the sharpshooter just to be a dick, which is actually a good heel move. And the ref checks his arm 3 times, calls a win for Bret. Bret grabs the US title. Do you notice a different theme song play when he won? Like a much worse one, too. It was very weird. Bret poses with the belt as Sting just lays there dead. And finally, Bret leaves and the EMTs come out for Sting. So, again, to make this clear, Sting elbows the referee like an idiot, apparently thinking Bret shrunk 6 inches. Sting then hits his own head on the ring post like an idiot, knocking himself unconscious and taking himself out of the match, and then Sting loses. So Sting, entirely his fault here to lose this match. Nobody books a babyface like WCW. This match was way, 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 way worse than I remembered it being. This is the worst match we watched. It was Bret Hart and Sting was significantly worse than like Lex Luger and Ming. Like I don't even know how that's possible. But like there's almost no redeeming qualities about this at all. Like stalling from Bret, lifeless offense, dead crowd, our fifth straight terrible finish, and probably the worst one of them all, honestly. I gave it 0.5 star. And that might be generous. It might be generous, I should say. Terrible. Terrible, terrible match.
I still think Luger versus Ming was more boring. This match to me was boring for most of it and then didn't really get offensive until the ending. So I went 1.75 star. But it's funny because the first time I ever had heard about this match, like I didn't see the pay-per-view, but I had this WCW magazine that was like 1998 in review. So there was like two page spreads of each pay-per-view with like pictures of all the matches and like comments about the match. And then the Bret, like I remember this vividly because I was like, oh, I want to see Bret versus Sting so bad. And so for the Bret versus Sting match, they made it sound like this was like the most brutal, violent match like that had ever taken place. And like Sting had to be stretchered out and everything like that. And of course, when I finally saw it, I was greatly disappointed.
Yeah, it was really, really terrible. I mean, really terrible. So, I don't know what else to say. I mean, Bret, if you want to see, like, it does encapsulate Bret in 98 because, like, he clearly doesn't give a shit. He clearly does not want to be booked this way and clearly is, like, basically going out there almost under protest. And, you know, it's just, I mean, like, this is a guy who a year ago was a super hot heel who had one of the most famous moments in wrestling history happen to him. And this is what they're doing with him 11 months later. Having him wrestle a terrible match against Sting where he could be any other generic heel for a secondary title.
Do you think this match is even any better if Sting is fully healthy or Bret would have just been an asshole?
Was Sting hurt? I thought Sting just took a vacation.
I thought he was injured and that's why he left.
Oh,
I thought it was a knee thing, but I could be totally wrong. But that's...
Maybe you're right. I don't know. I thought it was just Sting taking a vacation. But anyway, either way, who knows, who cares? I don't think it would have been any better because Bret just didn't give a shit. So, yeah, I don't know. The last match we're going to talk about was from Halloween Havoc 99, which, do you know why this show is famous, Gerard? I'm sure you probably
do. This is the first Russo and Ed Ferrera written pay-per-view.
Well, the first show period, I think.
They were on a Nitro before. Or, no, was it Halloween Havoc then the Nitro? I don't remember.
I think it was Halloween Havoc then the Nitro, yeah.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
But it's, they're definitely the first pay-per-view.
Definitely the first pay-per-view, yeah. So, like, if you look at this card, I mean, everything goes like 5 minutes practically. I think the longest match in the entire show is Rick Steiner and Chris Benoit, 12 minutes and 50 seconds.
The card does not look bad on paper. The execution is another.
Yeah.
Like, no matter who's booking, Goldberg versus Sid is going to be a train wreck. Yeah. But it's the kind of train wreck I would like to see. You know,
yeah. I mean, I really don't remember the show well at all. Honestly, the only thing I remember from it is the famous, like, Hogan lays down for Sting angle, which, of course, they totally ripped off. They ripped themselves off for Bash at the Beach, which was bizarre. And then the Goldberg beating Sting thing at the end with the open challenge. And then, which ended up being, what's the word? Like, it ended up being, like, completely, you know, rendered moot the next night.
Because they do the tournament.
Yeah. They strip Goldberg of the title. I don't know. I mean, it was a, I'm sure it was a weird, not that great show.
I only watched a few minutes after the match, but they were, of course, in Russo style, like doing like backstage angles, like a Monday night show style in between the matches on a pay-per-view and everything. And it's like, oh my God.
The pre-match promo here is Eddie Guerrero, Billy Kidman, and Torrie Wilson. Mike Tenay informs Eddie that the Filthy Animals and the Revolution have both been barred from ringside. He asks him for an update on Conan, so I guess he's been hurt or something. And we see that Eddie has Ric Flair's gold watch he stole from him earlier. And then he's aghast that Tenay would imply he's a thief. So, according to Tony, Saturn is one of the two remaining members of the Revolution. Now, I do remember this. Malenko and Benoit left the group, leaving it just to Saturn and Douglas, but Malenko immediately turns on Benoit. I don't know if it's on this show or if it's on Nitro the next night, but he immediately turns on Benoit and goes right back to the Revolution. So it ends up being like a three-man.
Like the Revolution because it's like going through the slog of 99 WCW when they formed. I was like, yeah, finally. Like, because, you know, those were the guys that I wanted to see pushed.
Yeah, but then I think they get, like, destroyed after that, though, so... Do you remember, the weird period where, like, when after Russo books them, he starts booking them as more of, like, a literal revolution where, like, they declare their own country?
I vaguely remember this. I feel like Saturn was, like, had a lot to do with that part, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really, really weird period. It's like, that's such a weird period. Saturn's overdub music, by the way, truly horrible. His network overdub music, it's like, really bad. The Animals, thankfully, still have their theme song and all its homemade or amateur rap glory, which, you know, I always like that song for some reason. And then Eddie gives the gold watch to the Brain because he doesn't trust that thief to Tony. Tony's reaction to that is actually pretty funny. But yeah, this match, I don't know how you felt about it. I enjoyed this a lot.
I loved this.
Yeah.
This is the best match.
Yeah, this was, I think, the best match we talked about. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the big problem was the crowd did not give a fuck. Like, a single fuck about this match, other than a few spots here and there. Like, there were points where, like, they were doing some pretty fun mat wrestling and, like, some stuff that was, you know, ahead of its time, if anything. And the crowd was, like, actively getting hostile. And you could hear some people chanting, like, starting like,
and that's not even Russo's fault. That's, like, how WCW had trained their crowds, basically.
Yeah. So, you know, it starts out with some nice little fast-paced action. Eddie uses the steps on the outside, but then Saturn comes back and press slams him on the side of them, which looks nasty. Saturn hits a nice little pop-up powerbomb. He, like, tosses Eddie in the ropes and then, like, tosses him up and powerbombs him and then floats over for a two count. That looked really cool. Hits, like, a twisting springboard crossbody, just getting his shit in here, I guess. And then gives him, like, a weird, like, arm drag into some kind of knuckle lock and then, like, transitions it into an arm bar. And again, this is not a crowd that's going to appreciate the finer points of mat wrestling. They're totally dead here, and, like, a few people start the boring calls. Saturn goes for a cross arm breaker, but that's not over at all here. And Eddie, in fact, you know, nearly gets pinned while he's in it to no reaction. He does hook his hands to block it and eventually gets out of it. You could tell a lot of this was just the two of them doing stuff they thought was cool and not really caring about the crowd, I don't think. But, you know, Saturn takes Eddie straight down to some kind of other wacky arm lock. Also gets no reaction. He lets Eddie out and, like, starts punching him. But Eddie gets out of it with a kick to the gut and, like, snapmares him and steps right on his face. Hits a nice basement dropkick. But Saturn comes back with an exploder. Like, a huge exploder suplex. Like, he really tosses Eddie across the ring. Eddie gets his foot on the ropes to break it when Saturn covers. Saturn, like, you know, starts going after the leg and, like, gets some kind of wacky leg lock. Eddie, like, pokes him in the eyes to break it, which is a great little way to break it. And then hits a backdrop suplex for a two count. And then when Saturn kicks out, Eddie goes straight into what looks like an attempt at, like, a key lock or something. Which, well-applied key lock, but the crowd does not want to see Eddie holds at all. So they're not into that at all. Saturn does this awesome, like, flip backwards just into Eddie, like, lifting Eddie straight up and, like, slamming him down out of the hold. Which, that looks so cool that it did get a reaction. And he hits a second rope lion salt for a two count. He goes for another one. Eddie gets his knees up this time. Eddie then follows up with a really nice front suplex with a little delay in the middle. Like, not quite I wouldn't call it a delayed suplex because the delay wasn't that long, but it did look pretty cool. And goes up top and goes for a frog splash, but Saturn rolls out of the way. And then Saturn tries to springboard off the middle rope. Eddie hits him with a counter drop kick in midair. Really cool little spot. He goes to charge Saturn in the corner. He misses and collides the turnbuckle. Saturn tries to set Eddie up on the top. Eddie pushes him away. Saturn comes right back with an interesting super kick to the legs that takes his legs out from under him. And then he hits a big superplex off the top, leaves both guys down. He crawls over and covers. Eddie kicks out. You know, then we get like a little, like, another superplex. But then, God forbid, we get anything resembling a finish on WCW's show, because Ric Flair comes charging out with a crowbar and assaults Eddie for the DQ. Kidman runs out. He gets beaten up too. And then, unfortunately, Tori runs out. Flair dances around her, forces himself on her for a kiss. And since this is October 1989, she loves being kissed against her will, apparently, and has a big smile. Not very cool. But there you go. And then Flair runs back out, remembers to get his watch, which I thought was... I bet that was a shooter, but he actually forgot to get the watch. But that was funny.
No, I thought that was just like a little, like, joke. Like, I was like... To me, I was like, wow, Russo actually booked a successful story arc closure.
Yeah.
But I thought it was just like a funny little touch. It worked better that way to me, with Flair having to come back out to room because he forgot his watch.
Yeah. I thought this was a ton of fun before he went 6-for-6 and terrible finishes. The live crowd hated it, but who gives a shit what these drunk Vegasites who are probably all comped think about this fucking match. They did some really nice mat wrestling. Probably ahead of its time for 99 in the U.S. and a bunch of cool spots. I went 3.5 because it was 11 minutes and I had a terrible finish, but I had a good time.
Well, my notes say, fuck it, 4 stars, actually.
Wow.
Because I just really love this match. I have always maintained that Saturn was an incredibly underrated talent.
Yeah, he was really good.
And I had forgotten, and I hadn't watched a Saturn match in so long, and I was just like, oh, goddamn, this is why I loved him so much, right? He was awesome.
Yeah, awesome, I mean, awesome. Like, a few more minutes and a real finish, and this would have been 4 stars for me, easy too, but the only thing, like, this match has, like, a, you know, really low average on grapple, only, like, 6 people, but, like, it has, like, a 2.5. I'm just like, this is, like, one of those matches where people are rating it based on the crowd reaction, I guess, because, like,
or just having to sit through a WCW show.
I guess so. But yeah.
Because if you're sitting through a show, the match is like, you know, a decent, like, 3.5, even maybe almost 4 level, but has a shitty ending, you're just going to, like, bury the whole thing, even if it was decent.
That's a good point. That is a good point. So, overall, I would say the results of this experiment, mixed at best.
Well, I mean, think about this. I don't know. I think there's been... I was listening to the 5-star match game, and the bonus question was how many matches had there been in Halloween Havoc history. It's, I think, 111 or something like that. It was like 110, between 110, 120. But think about this. We do the random 6, and in out of 4 of the 6 matches, basically involve the same two people interfering, Ric Flair and Harley Race, in the finishes. And this is totally random.
Yeah. And every single one has some kind of terrible finish. I don't know. It was like, this definitely scratched my itch for WCW nostalgia. I don't know if I'm going to, it did not make me want to go leap through the archives and watch more, let's just say.
Well, I mean, if you were like, I'm just going to put a bunch of cruiserweight matches from whether they be on Nitro or a pay-per-view in a randomizer, I think it'd be a different story.
Yeah.
But you'd have to, like, if you wanted to do good WCW random matches, you'd have to, like, curate the list that you put in the randomizer.
Exactly. But I hope you had fun with it anyway, Gerard.
It was an interesting look back. My biggest takeaway, though, out of all of this was, like, Bret Hart was a miserable bastard.
Yeah.
And Saturn was fucking awesome and should get more love.
Yeah. Those are two good takeaways. My other takeaway, again, is even this still felt way more like, even with all the terrible finishes and stuff, at least this felt like wrestling, which watching WWE nowadays, and even AEW, kind of, it doesn't often feel like wrestling.
That's true. So. I do agree with that. Also, it's funny because we were talking about the finishes. They hired Johnny Ace to do the finishes in the summer of 2000 and didn't do anything.
I guess he just... Can't get past that Russo suck, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, probably that's what it was. But they like specifically hired him to do the finishes.
Yeah. Well, there you go, folks. Gerard, you got anything you want to plug?
As we're heading into November, I will have a big preview of the Real World Tag League and coverage of all the shows. So watch for that on voicesofwrestling.com.
All righty. And of course, folks, you can follow us on Twitter at WrestleOmakase, Wrestling Wouldn't Fit. Next week, we'll be going back to covering current wrestling here. I'm very, very pleased to be joined by returning guest Haley will be joining me. And she and I will be talking about three big shows from New Japan, Power Struggle. I don't know why my brain went to Dominion for a second. I'm like, it's definitely not Dominion. Yeah, so New Japan, although both Osaka, maybe that's why. But yeah,
same
main event too, that's true. New Japan Power Struggle, DDT Ultimate Party, and Tokyo Joshi Wrestle Princess. So we'll be talking all three of those shows. Be fun to do some DDT and Tokyo Joshi. We haven't done it in a while here with all the tournaments that we've been covering and stuff. But yeah, that'll be fun. Of course, patreon.com/wrestlingomakase. If you like this retro roulette format, I think we'll do another one maybe for Starrcade, maybe for something else. I don't know. So that'll be like a different thing to do with the five matches, you know, different way of, covering old stuff. I think we will probably do that on the Patreon going forward. But yeah, I mean, this is a fun little thing to do here for Halloween, but we'll be definitely back to covering current wrestling and current Japanese wrestling starting next week, which, you know, kicks off a run of covering, you know, the DO and the two New Japan tournaments. So that'll be taking up our time here for the next month or so. And again, it'll be all over on the Patreon too. So patreon.com/wrestlingomakase. In the meantime, folks, but thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.